Hello and welcome to the AdFontes podcast. My name is Ansi Kamel. I am the editor at large at the journal AdFontes, and I'm joined as always, or at least most of the time, by my co-host Reese Laverty, the new senior editor at AdFontes. Reese, it's great to be here with you.
Shut up and get back to work, Ansi.
That's right. I know. See, now before, this podcast was like my podcast because it fell under the aegis of AdFontes, and now it's not. So I'm the host, but Reese could demote me whenever he wants.
Mm-hmm. I've delegated that responsibility to you. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. The stream, the kind of direction of authority has just reversed, and now I'm in an uncomfortable spot. There are power dynamics that I'm not comfortable with in this relationship now, Reese. But congratulations.
Well, thank you. I would like everybody to know that, you know, like any successful leadership coup, I wish it to be known that any of the positive things that should be said about Ansi, I wish to say. So there we go.
Thank you. That's right. I am extremely handsome. Thank you, Reese. Yeah. Well, I appreciate it. And Reese, I'm super excited for you to be taking over. I've been pushing Reese to do this and pushing for Reese for a long time, and I'm excited to see it come to fruition. I have every confidence that you will do an excellent job in your new vocation.
Oh, look at
boom!
That.
Look
so
at
smooth.
That transition.
So smooth.
So now that
and
I've
Colin,
talked...
sorry, and we should say we're talking about vocation today, and Colin is not here because he's on That's vacation.
Right. That's right. That's right. He's an absentee. He's failing in his vocation, actually, which is, I think...
Or is he, if he's with his family and he has been, you know, vacare'd?
But Reese, everyone has multiple vocations, and he's failing in this one. So, you know. Anyway, so Reese, yeah, we're talking about vocation. You have a new vocation. That's kind of beside the point. But I don't remember who initially wanted to talk about this, whether it was me, as you think, or you, as I think. But you insisted that we do this episode. So why did you insist? Why talk about vocation?
Well, for the record, Ansi thought of this, and then we kept having other things to do and to talk about that were slightly more time sensitive.
I don't remember that version of events. So.
That is what happened. But then because Ansi had said it ages ago, it was therefore on my mind, and therefore I kept thinking about it and said, let's keep doing it. And then Colin wasn't here. I was like, right, let's do the thing that Ansi definitely wanted to do and that I've been thinking about ever since he said we should talk about it. But there are other reasons to talk about the doctrine of vocation. Other than that, it is, once you get into, you know, kind of beyond the ABC doctrines of Reformation theology, vocation... and what that is, we immediately think of work, and it's plenty to do with work, but as we've alluded to, it's actually about much more than your work. But vocation is kind of one of the doctrinal areas where significant change happened in the Reformation era, and from quite early on, from Luther's earliest writings, stuff about what we think about vocation and work and our place in the world and how we fit into society. Big changes are afoot in those areas. Fast forward 500 years, and everyone likes to talk about how much of a different kind of professional landscape we're in these days. So, you know, the days of the 40-50 year career in a 9-to-5 job, the same company, everyone says they're long gone. We're in the gig economy. Millennials flip from job to job to job, don't really have a career, or they may have several different careers over the course of their life. And then people are often then torn between one thing and the other, or always questioning, you know, what on earth should I do with my life? What is my calling? What is my vocation? Same word, the Latin vocare, to call. That's where we get the word from. Even though we kind of look with disdain on the incredibly inhuman and historically anomalous idea of spending 50 years in a career in the same cubicle every day, driving an hour there, driving an hour back. And we should disdain that in many, many, many ways. As millennials do with the Gen Zers and boomers older than them, we envy a great deal about the clarity and the simplicity of that kind of
stability.
Job.
Yeah.
And the stability of it. Yeah. And, you know, and a vocation which, in the vast majority of cases, did finish at five. and then mm-hmm. you were home, and the rest of your life was the rest of your life, whereas now we are digitally connected all the time, and companies right. are always wrestling with being overconnected and on your devices and being reachable wherever you are or whatever. So the question of kind of what vocation is and how we handle it, how significant it is to our lives, is just a very live one, and so it seemed like one to go and have a look at on the Ad Fontes podcast. Yeah,
and I think to build on that point, one of the reasons why it's important to talk about Protestantism and vocation in particular is because, unbeknownst to a lot of people, whenever you hear someone saying Christian or not Christian, I hear this sort of language all the time. Whenever you hear someone saying, well, I just believe that being a nurse is my vocation, or a teacher is my vocation, or, you know, X is my vocation, that's Protestant doctrine. Right. That's the ability to make that claim, that X job or, you know, life sort of purpose or something is my personal vocation, is a way of speaking and thinking that develops very explicitly out of the Reformation. So I think we don't want to get too bogged down in the history, but we do want to go back to the sources as our kind of point of departure. So before we get to the Reformation, why don't we go before the Reformation and talk a little bit about medieval vocation? I'll just kind of say a couple of things and then you can sort of supplement, Rhys, if you want. But I think the first thing to note is that in the Middle Ages, not everyone had a vocation. In fact, very, very few people had a vocation. So in the Middle Ages, vocation is a technical term, and it refers specifically to people who are called vocari. There's that word again, called to be priests and monks. So the way of speaking in the Middle Ages would have been, I think I have a vocation, or I don't have a vocation. I know I don't have a vocation, right? So the question is, have you been called into the priesthood, into monastic life, and so on? And of course, you know, as a percentage of the population, relatively few people were. Very few people then, in total, were called by God, because those who were called by God were the priests and monks. And there were special obligations and privileges that attended having a vocation of being a priest or a monk. There was a kind of special, Luther will attack this in his Judgment on Monastic Vows, but this doctrine of perfection, right? That monks and particularly monks, monastic vows, the fulfillment of the monastic vocation constitutes a second baptism, and there's a kind of higher degree of perfection that monks attain, and they have to follow a sort of broader set of Christ's teachings called the evangelical councils, whereas most people only had to follow what were called the precepts of the gospel, right? The law. And we can get more into that if you want. But the point, the main point that I'm driving at is that this doctrine of vocation stratified society into different classes, right? There were those who were called by God, who had special rights and special obligations and special perfection, and those who were not called by God, and so who didn't have special rights, obligations, and who lacked that kind of extra perfection. They didn't get that second baptism. So there were the few. I mean, so like, I don't know, in the United States, the tagline for the Marines is like, the few, the proud, mm-hmm. the Marines. You know, I mean, it's like, this is like the few, the proud, the called, right? There's this kind of like sense in which the, you know, the people with vocations are few and proud. And so mm-hmm. what the Reformation is going to do, particularly with Luther, is start trying to dismantle that kind of system root and branch. So I don't, is that a decent summary, you think? You have things to add to that?
Yeah, nothing to add to that. It plays into the wider doctrine built up in the Middle Ages of the difference between the spiritual and temporal estate.
Exactly, right. This can't be disconnected from the estates. Yeah,
yeah. It's kind of one manifestation of it relative to the priesthood and relative also to work, even though it kind of, it's not a doctrine about work, it's a doctrine about the priesthood, and by implication that means that other forms of work are, you know, just are not callings and not worthy of as much consideration. And this is one of, this is in Luther's Babylonian captivity, he has these three walls that he says kind of surround and protect the medieval church, and those are what he wants to dismantle. The first being the difference between the spiritual estate and the temporal estate, and the papacy's insistence that the spiritual estate will always trump the temporal. So essentially, the Pope can tell any monarch, tell any ruler what to do, and they will have to do it. And it's only shortly after that that Luther, the swiftness with which he dives into dismantling that is pretty breathtaking when you read Babylonian Captivity, because like he introduces this first wall and then it's a few paragraphs later where he says, to put the matter even more plainly, if a little company of pious Christian laymen were taken prisoners and carried away to a desert and had not among them a priest consecrated by a bishop and were there to agree to elect one of them, married or unmarried, and were to order him to baptize, to celebrate the mass, to absolve and to preach, this man would as truly be a priest as if all the bishops and all the popes had consecrated him. Like, that's a kind of 0-60 dismantling of the medieval temporal estate, spiritual estate, and sense of calling. Because you know, where does the calling come from? A good question to ask at any point in the conversation about vocation. Well, who's calling you in this conversation? In the medieval church, who would they say is calling you? It's God or the church.
Right.
The two are made synonymous, and you only need to read a few stories of, you know, various famous figures in church history being forced into ordination against their will.
Which, to be honest, is kind of awesome. Like, I do sometimes wish that Protestantism had not done away with, like, the mobs forcing people to become bishops. It's just like, because the thing is, then you're left with people who want to be bishops being bishops, which is just not a good idea, right? Like, a good bishop should not want to be a bishop. I've met bishops who want to be bishops, and I don't like the ones who...
But it's a noble thing to desire to be an overseer. And I don't know, maybe you haven't seen what I've seen in, you know, certain circles of English Reformed conservative evangelicalism, especially the Anglican circles, where any you know, confident young man who is someone recently dubbed a bloke worth watching sort of receives the tap on the shoulder saying, have you thought about full-time Christian ministry and gospel work? which is much the same thing. So Luther, in seeking to dismantle the division between the spiritual and temporal estates, the spiritual and temporal swords, that then pulls in the doctrine of vocation, because he can't start talking about dismantling the big picture without immediately getting into the weeds of, you know, who is it who's going to call this priest? Well, Luther says ultimately the church, but just the people of the church, not the Pope, not the office, but a bunch of Christians can call somebody to be a priest, to baptize, to do whatever.
So before we get into like the specifics about the kind of call to ministry, because I have some concerns about that. I want to get your thoughts on that a little bit later. But let's leave the listeners in suspense a little while longer. Let's kind of work out the broad outline of the doctrine of vocation as it's articulated by the Reformation, right? So Luther says, okay, spiritual estate, temporal estate, special vocation to the priesthood, you know, a vocation exclusive to the priesthood and the monastic orders. That's no bueno, right? We're not going that way. Luther thinks that that sort of destroys the kind of universality of the gospel, right? To say that only this particular class is called by God and has these, you know, has to follow all of Christ's teachings. So he says, no, the whole gospel is for all of God's people. All of God's people have to obey the entirety of the gospel. There isn't a distinction between the precepts and the evangelical councils. And so then what does Luther think follows from that? That the gospel is for all people. It follows from that all people ought to be living the gospel fully and completely in every dimension of their lives, right? Because it's not the case that there's a special set of people who go off and live the gospel more perfectly than other people. And so if that's not the case, then everyone has to be living the gospel fully in their own lives, which means that the gospel suffuses every dimension of a human life, that everything that a human is doing should be done in a way that is according to the gospel, in a manner in accordance with the gospel. And so I think that sort of insight is the basis of Luther's doctrine of vocation, because now Luther will say everything that you are in fact doing, whether you're married or celibate or a shopkeeper, or, you know, a homemaker, or a barber, whatever it is, you have a calling to that. All of those dimensions of your lives are ordered, should be ordered by the gospel, and therefore you have a calling to be doing them in a manner that accords with what God has established. And Luther will develop his doctrine of the three estates and so on. And we can actually post a link to that. We should try to remember to do that. Mm. We had a great essay in Ad Fontes a few years ago on the doctrine, Luther's, you know, three estates. I think it was by Michael Laffin.
Yeah.
So we'll try to put a link to that in the show notes.
Three estates being the state, the church, the household, right? Slash family.
Right. Yeah. But so Luther will argue that the family becomes a primary site of vocation for people. Mm-hmm. And so I guess one final reflection, then I want to get your thoughts on this, Reese. But it seems to me that in sort of arguing that all people have an equal obligation to the gospel, to live out the gospel, and in therefore arguing that all people are called to do what it is they're doing for God, this has like a radically democratizing effect, right? Because the prince now is called to be a prince by God, and the street sweeper is called to be a street sweeper by God. And therefore, the prince and the street sweeper both have this kind of equal, their vocations take on a similar dignity, right? There's this kind of similar dignity afforded to them both, because they're both placed where they are placed by God for God's service, for the love of their neighbors, right? I mean, and so it's this kind of radically democratizing effect. Luther will say that there's one vocation that is superior to all other vocations, and that's the vocation of marriage, that God has ordained marriage above everything else. He said it's better to be married than to be a bishop or a pope. And we can talk about why that is later. So he doesn't completely do away with the kind of differentiations between vocations. There's a special dignity for certain vocations, but the vocations for which there's a special dignity are vocations to which, you know, essentially everyone in theory has access, right? And so that's kind of his vision. So it's still this kind of radically democratizing vision of vocation.
Yeah, and that's in the Freedom of Christian is one of the places where Luther will expound what we would now call the priesthood of believers, saying contra the medieval distinction between the clergy and the laity and the spiritual and temporal. Everyone is a priest, and also everybody's a king, which is why the
spiritual king. He gets much more insistent on the spiritual after the Anabaptists go crazy. But
On the Anabaptists also, he doesn't really have any room in the Freedom of Christian for saying everybody is a prophet, which is
that's true. That's true.
A notable lack. If you're gonna get it, harp on it, or maybe it wasn't as notable at the time because Calvin did a lot of the work on priest, prophet, king, though it's not original to him. Yes. But so everybody's a spiritual king in that we're not under the kind of absolute necessary authority of anybody, and that's why the great line of Freedom of Christian is that the Christian is the kind of slave
perfectly
to none.
Free lord of all, slave to none, yeah. And the perfectly subservient servant of all, slave to all.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. And because our subservience to anybody else is not for our justification, it's not to make us right with God, but actually our subjection to anyone is done willingly and is done out of love for our neighbor. I can't see what it's just saying. Right. Yeah.
So are there like particular dimensions of Luther? I mean, because at least to me, Luther is like really the inaugurator of the doctrine of vocation, but he's also kind of the most, I don't know, rhetorically moving exponent of the doctrine of vocation and of like the sort of decency and goodness and God-belovedness of ordinary life. Are there particular dimensions that you want to focus on, Reese, like before we start trying to apply this, you know, to today, or ask how it applies to today?
Yeah, no, well, I think as we've touched on, you could then to make this point at maybe some more length, that vocation is not just about work. But Antti's already said, Luther says this is marriage is a great vocation. And so actually, any place you've been placed in life, And all this really comes from 1 Corinthians 7, where Paul exhorts people to remain as you were when you were called. If you're married, remain where you are. If you're a slave, he says, remain a slave, though if you can, buy your freedom, do. Countering the idea that entry into the kingdom of God will suddenly sever all of your earthly ties. Actually, no, it pushes you to continue to adhere to those things. And you see that reflected throughout the rest of the New Testament as well. So there's exhortations to work so that you can provide for those who are in need. That's Ephesians 4, 28. If you don't provide for your family, 1 Timothy 5, 8, you are worse than an unbeliever. So actually, like, the expectation is that Christians will continue to maintain sort of levels of piety and obligation in their earthly relationships that even unbelievers can understand. So any of your kind of natural bonds that you've been placed into are vocations. So you will have a vocation as a husband, you'll have a vocation as a son, you'll have a vocation as a parent, have a vocation as a citizen, as a friend, as a neighbor. So actually all of these things are already vocations. And to move towards kind of addressing the question we opened with, this contemporary existential angst about finding your vocation, well, the answer is actually you've got a lot of vocations and you're just kind of really torn up about one, your career. When in fact, you know, I think part of the answer to that is to tell people, well, are you looking at your other vocations and asking how well you're executing them, and what priority are you giving to those? Or is actually just everything becoming about your kind of, you know, your professional vocation, rather than asking, how am I executing my duties as a son, as a husband, as a father, as a friend, as a neighbor, as a member of this community, as a citizen, whatever it might be. So I think that's a big thing to note with Luther. It's not just about work and, you know, making the farmer feel like he is, the equal of the priest, though it is about that, but it's about making them feel that both as both in their work and in their family and the other levels at which they're engaged.
No, that's really good. I just wanted to read a little bit from his Estate of Marriage to build on that point. This is what Luther says about marriage. He says, now the ones who recognize the estate of marriage are those who firmly believe that God himself instituted it, brought husband and wife together, and ordained that they should beget children and care for them, right? So look at the action there, right? God institutes marriage, God brings husband and wife together, and God ordains that they have children. So that's the language of vocation there, right? God creates something, he calls people to it, and then he orders their life within it. Now here's what Luther says. They can therefore, those who recognize the estate of marriage, be certain that the estate of marriage and everything in it that goes with it in the way of conduct, works, and suffering is pleasing to God. Now tell me, how can the heart have greater good, joy, and delight than in God when one is certain that his estate, conduct, and work is pleasing to God? Right, so I think the an extra dimension of Luther's teaching of vocation is that if God has placed you where you are and he's given you a particular vocation, in fulfilling that vocation, you are doing God's work and are therefore pleasing to him. You know, so this, I think, gets to a lot of the questions about, like, you know, particularly in the kind of evangelicalism I grew up in, you know, pray to hear God's will for your life, right? If you don't know God's will for your life, ask him and he'll show you his will for your life. Well, his will for your life is what you're doing, right? It's being a husband or a wife or a father or a child or a brother or a sister. And so one of the things that I think Luther is extremely helpful in is that not only does he elevate the ordinary dimensions of human life, you know, if you're a barber, you know, cut hair to the glory of God, sort of a thing. So not only does he elevate those dimensions of human life, but he also allows us to rest in them, right? There isn't this sort of like internal struggle about, like, should I be doing this? I don't know what God wants from me, blah, blah, blah. God wants for you what what you've been placed in, right? I mean, that's sort of what he wants for you.
I think. Sorry.
Yeah. No. Keep going. Keep going on that.
Well, and it definitely counters that that need to always find your specific vocation. For me, it counters a kind of a dichotomy that I've experienced a lot. I don't know if this is as much a thing in the US, but it's just very much a kind of hot potato among young, thoughtful Christians when I was end of university age, certainly when I was a church trainee, of, you know, how do you view work? What's your theology of work? T- Tim Keller has done a lot on this over the years, and so it is in, you know, this is coming on 10 years ago, around when I left university, 8 years ago. So things have moved on since then, but the time is a very big thing. And yeah, there's often these two camps. There's the, what I'll call the feed your face camp, which is to quote from a slightly infamous sermon on work by an Australian preacher who was visiting the UK once. And what's the purpose of work? To feed your face. And like, kind of, that's it. You work to survive, to have enough money to feed your face. And in this side of the fall, that's all the work is. It's just to feed your face. And then often on the opposite end of the spectrum, you have sort of the renewal of all things camp.
Spreadsheets bring about the new creation, right? The new heavens and the new earth.
Yeah.
And Mike, I actually heard that in a sermon once. There will be Excel spreadsheets in the new heavens and new earth because all of your work is working to, like, anyway. Yeah.
Well, this is what you get from some people. So someone like Chris Wright, who is also Langham Place, head of the Langham Partnership, protege of John Stott, Old Testament scholar. He'll write a lot about this and writings about mission and the mission of the church and whatever, with this really eschatological bent that in all that you're doing in your work, everything you do as a Christian is mission, and everything is, you know, kind of participating in the renewal of all things,
right?
And is foretaste of the new creation, not like, you know, not in the kind of liberal creating heaven on earth sort of way, but in a way that's attempting to give dignity to things. And, you know, what sort of people should we be? 2 Peter 3, those who are working in anticipation of a new creation where righteousness dwells. But I think someone like Chris would read prophecies in, like, Isaiah, where it says about the riches of the nations will be brought in on the day of the Lord, you know, kind of into the new creation. Would read that even to say that the kind of best of human creativity and culture will be there in the new creation. You know, we'll be listening to Beethoven in glory. Like, maybe we will, maybe we won't, I don't know. But I think that Luther's way of talking about vocation sort of cuts the Gordian knot, because I think it's certainly more than the feed your face brigade, because it's about love, loving your neighbor in all that you do in your profession, and love remains, 1 Corinthians 13. In some way, I don't know about the artifact itself or the work itself, but if that thing is done in love for your neighbor, whether that's the immediate neighbor of your family or the wider neighbors of society or whatever, the love in which that work is done has some mysterious eschatological value. I don't really know what I think 1 Corinthians 13 especially means when it talks about love remaining, but it means something. So it's more than the feed your face brigade. And I think it sort of reins in some of the renewal of all things way of speaking. There is an eschatological element to all of the work that you do when it's done in love. The focus is on the neighbor, kind of, rather than the eschatological beauty of the thing. Yeah. And I think there is a slight elitist bent sometimes to the renewal of all things, because it's always about, oh, the best of our artifacts, the best of our arts will get there. But, you know, you could be excellent at creating a masterful network of, you know, interrelated spreadsheets or a glorious sewer system or something like that. But, like, we are less quick to say that those kinds of things,
the best even though sewer systems will be in the new heavens and the new earth.
Yeah, and like, if under it's the riches of the kings of the earth,
there's a sewer of gold, you know. And it's
like, yeah, why do you think they're so clean? You know, because they drain wonderfully.
Beautifully, yeah.
Yeah, so I think Luther's focus on this is about love of your neighbor really solves some of that. It's a misattributed Luther quote, isn't it? Oh, if I knew the world was going to end today, I'd plant an apple tree tomorrow. Okay, maybe he would say that, but I think he'd say that, like, because, you know, I mean, let's assume this is an apple tree that's going to fruit overnight. He would plant it because it was going to love his neighbor, or because it would give him shade, not necessarily for the kind of inherent joy of apple growing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. No, I think that's a really good way of putting it. I mean, one way of articulating, I think maybe one way of getting to the root of what the Reformation is saying about vocation is that it's saying loving your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and loving your neighbor as yourself is equally applicable to everyone, and therefore everyone should be doing it in everything that they do. That just is the Protestant doctrine of vocation.
Yep.
Everything you do, do those two things. Whereas the sort of prior model was
also the ancient Israelite doctrine of vocation.
but I mean, the whereas, like, the medieval church was like, no, there are some people who will be able to fulfill these commands to a greater degree than other people. And the Reformation says, nope, everyone fulfills them, has an obligation to fulfill them equally, and can fulfill them equally, and therefore in everything that you do. And that just is what vocation is. And
we can say that in one way that, you know, there are people who are way more godly than I am. And to some extent, they can fulfill those commands to a greater extent than I can. I think their reward in heaven will be greater than me. They've surpassed me in Christ's likeness. But that's not some like inherent ontological difference. There's no necessary reason why I could not also be like that. It's kind of a question of Christian maturity rather than a difference of state or estate. Yeah.
Yeah. Reese, you know, at the beginning of this podcast, when you said that you were going to compliment me in all the requisite ways, I didn't realize you were going to go quite so eloquent with it, but, you know, I'm on it.
It reminds me of a conversation. I don't know if I've said this before. I like telling this story. Conversation I had once with my pastor, student minister, when I was at university. We used to meet up, read the Bible every week. I said to him one week, I said, Chris, I just, you know, all the godliest men I know, they get up at like 5 in the morning. I don't think I'm ever going to be able to do that. And he said, well, it's okay. Yeah, I don't do that. And I said, oh, I wasn't thinking of you.
That's great. Yeah, yeah.
But he has definitely surpassed me in Christ likeness, and I
yeah, since
very unlikely to be as godly as he is. Yeah.
Okay. So two things, because I like all of that. You know, obviously I'm a fan of the Reformation's doctrine of vocation. I'm still not sold on it for a couple of reasons.
And Anansi loves Luther, guys. Like, when Anansi says, this is where I disagree with Luther, alarm bells ring. And he's got an even hotter take on where he disagrees with Luther. Buried in here.
I just have questions.
Just asking questions.
No, the place I really disagree with Luther is, like, the desert island thing. But that's...
The priest. Well, but that, and I think, as we've said, that's beneath this, isn't it? You know?
Yeah. I don't think that, you know, a bunch of people on a desert island can just sort of make you a priest. Anyway, doesn't matter. Okay. On vocation... So there are a couple of difficulties with the Reformation doctrine of vocation, right? The first is the Reformation still has to figure out a way to distinguish who should be a priest, right? So that problem doesn't actually go away, right? If you just say, well, everyone has this equal vocation to live by the gospel, and people are called to be husbands and wives and children and brothers and sisters and shopkeepers and, you know, butchers, some people are still supposed to be, you know, priests of Christ's church. And who are those people and how do you know who they are? And so in answer to that question, the Reformation develops its doctrine of calling, vocation, right? You know what I mean? So it develops a doctrine of the call, right?
There's vocation.
Right, there's vocation and vocation, right? And so what is the doctrine of the call? Well, for those who aren't familiar, the doctrine of the call is that only certain people are to be ministers in Christ's church. Who are those people? Those whom Christ has called. And the Reformation, so I can just read a little bit from like Luther's commentary in Galatians, and I've got some Calvin on calling too. But Luther says God calls in two ways, either by means or without means. Today, he calls all of us into the ministry of the word by a mediated call, that is, one that comes through means, namely through man. But the apostles were called immediately by Christ himself, as the prophets in the Old Testament had been called by God himself. So what Luther's saying here is there still is actually a particular call for people who go into ministry. And that particular call is that the church now tells certain people, hey, you seem like you would be a good priest. We are commissioning you to be a minister of the gospel of word and sacrament. And so we're sort of inaugurating you into that call. There were some people who were immediately called by God in the past. Luther seems to think that doesn't happen anymore. But the point is there's a special calling for people who go into ministry. And so then, like, what is the payoff, Reese? I guess this is my question. What is the upshot of totally reinventing the doctrine of vocation just to end up at a place where, oh, right, but there's still people who are called. And then they're just, you know, normal people are called, right? You know, but there are people with a real call, you know, like a churchy call, right? So like what's going on there? Why is that a misguided concern?
Well, I mean, Luther will see that there is a difference, but it's not a difference, like we said, of estate, but it's just a difference of office or ministry. So he talks about this in Freedom of a Christian. Now, honestly, you might feel like this is just a distinction without a difference. But, you know, there's no ontological change. There's no difference in that person's merit before God. So I'll read a bit from Freedom of a Christian, and then we can talk about whether it makes any difference. Here you will ask, if all who are in the church are priests by what? If all who are in the church are priests, by what character are those whom we now call priests to be distinguished from the laity? I reply, by the use of these words, priest, clergy, spiritual person, ecclesiastic, an injustice has been done, since they have been transferred from the remaining body of Christians to those few who are now, by a hurtful custom, called ecclesiastics. For Holy Scripture makes no distinction between them, except that those who are now boastfully called popes, bishops, and lords, it calls ministers, servants, and stewards, who are to serve the rest in the ministry of the word, for teaching the faith of Christ and the liberty of believers. So there's a difference of ministry and office rather than like any actual kind of substantial difference between the people. And there's a means by which you end up called to that. But I think that that's probably true of a great deal of vocations, maybe not so much in Luther's day where you were sort of, you know, a peasant, just as your father was a peasant. If he was a butcher, you'd probably be a butcher. But when people display aptitude for a certain gift, with a certain gift and for a certain calling, then they get the tap on the shoulder and say, hey, you know, your boy's pretty clever. Have you thought of sending him off to study to be a lawyer? Or, hey, he's got a, you know, strong arm. Have you thought of making him a woodcutter or whatever?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's early Luther, right? After the Anabaptists decide to lead a revolution because they have a special calling, Luther strengthens his doctrine of the ministerial call. So I'm going to read from his lectures on Galatians. This is from 1535, so it's a mature work. It's 15 years after the freedom of the Christian. Because it is the case that if you're called to the priesthood, you're still called out of one estate into another estate, in a certain sense, right? Your primary, everyone participates in all of the estates, but in different respects. Let me just read this and then we'll... So after he talks about the mediated and immediate call, here's what he says. Afterwards, the apostles called their disciples, as Paul called Timothy. These men called bishops, as in Titus chapter 1, verses 5 and following. And the bishops called their successors, down to our own time, and so on to the end of the world. This is a mediated calling, since it is done by man. Nevertheless, it is divine. So there's a divine calling, mediated by man, apostolic succession, with a kind of different... you know, understanding of that than like the Catholics of his time, doesn't matter. But here's what he goes on to say. Thus, when someone is called by a prince or a magistrate or me, he has his calling through man. Since the time of the apostles, this has been the usual method of calling in the world. It should not be changed. It should be exalted on account of the sectarians who despise it and lay claim to another calling by which they say the Spirit drives them to teach. So he's saying, look, the Anabaptists, they say the Spirit gives them these like immediate revelations and calls them to teach. No, that's anarchy. We should have mediated calling. So through the church and the institutions of the world. So here's what he says. They are liars and imposters, for they are being driven by a spirit who is not good but evil. It is not lawful for me to forsake my assigned station as a preacher, to go to another city where I have no call and to preach there. I have no right to do this, even if I hear that false doctrine is being taught and that souls are being seduced and condemned, which I could rescue from error and condemnation by my sound doctrine. But I should commit the matter to God, who in his own time will find the opportunity to call ministers lawfully and to give the word. For he is the Lord of the harvest who will send laborers into his harvest. Our task is to pray. So this is kind of interesting. I mean, to your point, later down, he'll say, when the prince or some other magistrate calls me, then with firm confidence, I can boast against the devil and the enemies of the gospel. I have been called by the command of God through the voice of a man. For the command of God comes through the mouth of a prince, and this is a genuine call. So that's kind of interesting. So I guess maybe the answer to my question would be to say that the vocation to the priesthood is a particular calling, but it's mediated by one of the estates. And this is why Luther's doctrine of the estates is so important, because all of the estates are ultimately means by which God works in the world. So God works through the civil magistrate, God works through the church, and God works through the family. Mm-hmm. And so the calling that a minister has to minister in the church and the calling that a civil servant has to minister to the magistrate are actually both calls from God. Mm-hmm. They're not actually different kinds of calls. God is calling person to a particular service through these means that he has instituted, whether it's the magistrate or the bishop. And so in both cases, actually, God is calling someone to fulfill a particular office. So maybe that's the answer to my question, that there is, that I was wrong in my initial, some people are still called to the church. And you were right because there isn't the distinction in types of calls. God is calling in both cases.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess
that's what Luther would say. I'm still not sure about that, but resolves the contradiction.
Yeah, I guess to take it through the three estates, you know, if there's a call from your civic community that you know, I don't know, they're a very different kind of civic community to ours, but you've got to step up to lead, or you're drafted, say, for let's say what is in principle a just war. You know, that's a call in your vocation as a citizen that you must heed, and actually because God has put you in place as a citizen, you must heed that. Similarly, if there are calls upon you as a member of a family, you have to heed those, and you're a sinner if you don't, worse than an unbeliever. So you get a woman pregnant. If you don't step up to the call to be a father, then you've ignored a call given to you by God. Funny with the church and ordination and Christian ministry, because we've talked about times where people are forced into great figures from church history who then clearly did a lot of good, but were forced into their ministry. Specific examples escape me. Was Ambrose forced into ordination, I think?
Yes, Ambrose was. Augustine was too.
Augustine's you know, and then I know people who are constantly tapped on the shoulder and being told they should go into Christian ministry. But that's often by people who basically think the ministry is the only job worth doing and that person is wasting their time.
So if they're doing anything but ministry.
Yeah, so I know good examples, but that person is kind of turning the call essentially into a revival of a medieval view of the spiritual estate. So that's probably a good call a bad call worth ignoring. Whereas, you know, some people will be encouraged for years to go into ministry, and actually it's probably sinful that they haven't, because, I don't know, for whatever reason. I know people who may say that. I know people on the another estate who would say they were wrong for remaining single as they did for so long. You know, there's a lot of back and forth about, you know, the church denigrating singleness these days, but I know godly guys who actually look back on their life now, they're married, and be like, yeah, I had bad reasons for staying single for so long. Not in a kind of, you know, man-child sat in their dungeon playing Xbox sort of ways, but so I've slightly rambled here, but
what's the point of being single if you can't play Xbox all the time? I mean, seriously, that's like,
it can be a tricky thing to work out that call to ministry, but I think the key thing you said, when and how it does come, should be from the church. We shouldn't just go and make our own call and go and set up shop in wherever we want, and, you know, insist that we should be in the ministry if actually the church and a specific congregation, like my congregationalism coming out here, hasn't called us to do it.
And I guess maybe this is a little beside the point, but Luther's actually doctrine of the call kind of helps you know, the installation of bishops used to be a much more sort of complicated jurisdictional mess, you know, in church history than it is now, where basically the church gets to decide who's going to be, you know, the bishop or archbishop or whatever. You know, it used to be that civil authorities had much more control over bishoprics and who they wanted in those posts. And in Alexandria, you know, bishops were actually ordained by a convocation of all the presbyters until like the 4th or 5th century, not by other bishops. So there are a lot of these like kind of strange, thorny questions that if you have like a different doctrine of vocation, you might have trouble working out. Is it legitimate for a bishop to be called by civil authority, or, you know, so on and so forth? But I think Luther's point is that all of these calls are from God. Ultimately, they're just mediated by human institutions. Okay.
And I think a very good book on this and the unfolding of this doctrine that people should read, which is core reading on our Reformation and the Modern World module on the Davenant Hall MLIT, is The Church and the Theology of the Reformers by Paul Avis. And it's fantastic. And it really just starts with Luther and all the kind of things we're saying, and shows the development of that stream of thought, the Protestant struggle to not end up with a clericalist view of the church, And this is why Brad likes it. It lands really with Richard Hooker and the kind of view of church ministry that that he and a couple of others articulate. So
I'm kind of a clericalist.
Theology of the church. So,
Brad and I, that was one of our first major disagreements, actually. It was about ordination. Anyway, okay, second problem. Reese, tell me why my second problem is misguided. So Luther's doctrine of vocation is supremely ennobling in a world in which most people have no choice but to do what they're already doing, right? So in a world in which, 80% of you are going to be farmers and, it's important to know that your farming is something that you're called to by God, has an intrinsic sort of dignity, that in fulfilling your obligations as a farmer and husband and father, you're actually living a life well-pleasing to God, that you don't need to actually go do a bunch of other stuff to please God. You just love him and love your neighbors where you are, and you will please God. So it's ennobling in a great many contexts, and it's still ennobling in a great many contexts today. Someone I met at Convivium, I think I talked about him a couple weeks ago on the show, but, has found this sort of sense very helpful to him as he works in a kind of, not glamorous office job. And the Protestant theology has really sort of helped him figure out how to do that in a way that's well-pleasing to God. So I don't want to denigrate that. But for a lot of us, our vocations... and I'm speaking colloquially here, what I mean is our jobs are not determined by what our parents have done, there are some limits on them, based on social class and education and interests that we're raised with and so on. So I don't want to deny any of that. But our vocations are, for many of us these days, kind of up for us to decide. Do I want to be a doctor or a cab driver or a construction worker? Like, these are like questions that in theory everyone is supposed to be sorting out for himself these days. How does the Protestant doctrine of vocation help us as we have to make these sorts of very difficult, thorny life decisions, right? I mean, Luther says, look, the construction worker and the lawyer can both, well, maybe not the lawyer, but, the doctor, whatever, can glorify God and love their neighbor and do God's will wherever they're placed equally well. Okay, but then how do I determine whether I should be a construction worker or a doctor, right? I mean, that's the sort of question. What are the means by which we do this, if not, like, I have some special vocation to it, right?
Yeah. Well, I think the observation that you have many vocations is the place to start, because part of the issue, like you said, is we reduce vocations simply to the call to our professional, how we spend our time professionally. And everything else is just good to have, but is not necessarily a calling upon us. So anybody, if they move somewhere for a career change, is probably going to toss up the struggle of proximity to family, proximity to friends, loyalty to your hometown, or maybe you hate your hometown and you've got sort of what I call born to run syndrome, where you just can't wait to get out of this, blow this popsicle stand, that kind of thing.
There must be more than this provincial life, in the words of the wise Disney princess, Belle. Indeed. Which, by the way, sorry, we've been listening to that with my daughter, because she loves the sound. She's old enough to listen to the soundtrack.
Maurice, the baguettes!
It's a great soundtrack, but Beauty and the Beast... Belle is like the worst. She's the absolute, she wakes up in the morning, everyone in the town is super nice to her. Good morning, Belle. How are you today? And then she's just like, ah, the stupid butcher. There must be more than the stupid town. And they're like, Belle, how are you? And she's like, well, instead of doing your job, let me tell you about this dragon fantasy I just read yesterday. It's like, what is your... Anyway, sorry. Really, really hate Beauty and the Beast now. Okay.
But then she comes back and then she rules over all the peasants with, her her formerly beastly lover. So, anyway.
Yeah, could you imagine being ruled by someone that snooty? It would just be awful. Well, maybe, I don't know, you guys probably...
Well, we oscillate in our...
So,
they're part of the furniture here. But we oscillate between these stories that actually love small towns and these stories that are all about getting out of the small towns. But anyway, that's another topic. Yeah, so so we think that those things are just sort of nice to have, the small town, the family nearby, etc., etc. But actually, those things are callings. They have an obligation. You have an obligation towards them. They have a demand upon you.
Yep.
And so actually, everything kind of falling onto the question of what job you do, as if that is your sole vocation, is part of the problem. And so I think when you're weighing that question up, you need to examine all of your other vocations. And it's just a bizarrely sort of Western thing, I think, for our career to mean that we end up living on the other side of the country, hundreds or thousands of miles away from our parents who may need us when they're old, or from people we grew up with, or like our wider family, you know, your cousins and aunts and all that kind of thing. That's just been so dissolved in the modern world that we live in, that is one of the reasons that people are so full of angst. But those things aren't just nice to have. Like, you know, I live in the town I grew up in. I've chosen to be here. So I hope I'm sort of, you know, kind of talking the talk, although I acknowledge and walking the walk, although I acknowledge that I've ended up being able to kind of do something I love and do so remotely and by the aid of digital technologies. So it can be really hard choices where you do have to make a call on which vocation you're going to sacrifice. I'm not saying that there's necessarily always one that has to give out to the other. That, like, your immediate family, your wife, your children are pretty much always the first thing, which is, I think, part of how we can make sense of Luther putting that calling above others. I think I'm doing that. I've chosen to be here. It could be elsewhere, because actually the things and the people here have a demand on me that I'm never going to get away from. And what would be the value of me moving 200, 300 miles away to fulfill another calling whilst abrogating the calling I've got here? So I think that is a huge part of it. And then, you know, weighing up whether the calling you feel towards this job or that job is actually going to help you to execute those callings better. It's probably a big part of it as well. And then other things like, well, is that calling actually something that's going to help you love your neighbor? Or, you know, could it be a calling that, okay, maybe it's what, you know, we'll call a bullshit job that sort of does nothing and just pushes paper around or just, you know, sells crap that people don't need. You know, it may be that that's not something you feel you want to do with your time, but we are also told to work hard so that we have money to share with those who are in need. So you may work a job that is not the most fulfilling thing in the world, but if actually that frees you up to obey your calling to share with those in need in the church and society around you, then that could be a way to do it as well. Those are my thoughts.
Okay. I don't know if I'm convinced, but you know, that was a good.
Auntie doesn't want to love his neighbor, guys. Is the takeaway there?
Well, I don't. No one does. I mean, that's why it's really hard. You know, it's like no one really wants to love their neighbor. Or maybe you like want to. You know, it's one of those things where it's like, I don't love my neighbor, but I wish I did.
Not yet.
See, Reese, I'm infinitely, you know, sort of worse off in my Christlikeness than you are. So, you know, you may be maybe lower on the totem pole than other people, but I'm lowest. I'm the least of all the, well, no, I'm not an apostle. What am I trying to say? The worst of all sinners, of whom I am the worst. I was going to say
of
least
the
of all, but
the worst of all
the editors. The least of all the, that's exactly, that's actually true now. Yeah, I'm at the bottom of the page now on the Adfontes.
One abnormally born.
I got demoted. My name was at the top of the masthead page and now
you
it's
were
at the
first.
Bottom. I'm below the poetry yet. I know. Paul is above me.
Below the poets.
I'm below the poets. I know. It's how the mighty have fallen. All right. Well, any final thoughts on this topic, Reese? I've actually kind of said everything I want to say, but we should be moving to our reading section.
Yeah.
So if you have
I've said everything I want to say. We without Colin here to, I don't know, without us spending our time reining in Colin and, you know, laughing at outrageous things he said, we've kind of freely, you know, loquaciously wandered for the past however hour or so. So
that's right.
I've said all I want to say.
Okay, great. So what are you reading then these days?
I've read the first novel I've read in, I don't know, 6 months or something like that. Now my academic term's finished, so I've got a bit more time on my hands. I finally read Piranesi, however you want to say it, by Susanna Clarke, which was a sort of fantasy novel sensation in 2020.
Yeah.
So she wrote Yeah, is it ringing a bell now?
It is. Yeah, I never so read it, but people were raving about it. Like, people who I don't associate with novel reading were like reading and raving about it.
Yeah, well, Alistair Roberts, our colleague, did a podcast episode on it with Susanna Black, his now wife, and Derek Rishmawi, which I now can listen to now that I've read it. Yeah, it just blew up. It's one of those times when like a work of fiction is really popular among all the conservative Christians.
Yeah, the last one that I remember that was like Lauris, which I did read and which was amazing, but I haven't read any of those books since then.
Yeah, no, I love Piranesi, and it's really short, really breezy, so I saw through it in a few days. She wrote another novel, which was a smash hit back in 2004, Jonathan Strange. No, Jonathan Norrell and Doctor Strange, sorry. And then it's years later that she has done the follow-up because she was really ill and had chronic fatigue in the intervening years.
I didn't realize that.
She talks about having a Christian faith. There's an interview with her in the Church Times. Susanna Clarke, I haven't prodded into it that much. But yeah, the conceit is this character, Piranesi, who lives in this alternate magical world called The House, which is these endless rooms and hallways and vestibules full of statues, which kind of then seem to have some relation with our world. The world he lives in has this echo of like living in the world of the Platonic forms and some relation between the statues and the thing that's in the world, and he's there searching for the great and secret knowledge, which seems to be like the wisdom of the ancients that's escaped the world, has kind of fled into the house somewhere. So lots very relevant to the whole disenchantment kind of conversation, honestly. I think that's why a lot of people in our circles really picked up on it. Lots of sideways references to Narnia, the opening quotations from The Magician's Nephew. It's like a kind of dark version of The Magician's Nephew. Yeah, I loved it. Lots to think about.
Okay. Cool. Well, for myself, I've been reading Arabic through the Quran, which is my Arabic textbook for this intensive Arabic class that I've been doing. I've also been dipping my toes into Severus of Antioch in my very, very, very little spare time. But yeah, so I'm learning Arabic right now. It's an intensive classical Arabic class. I'm almost done with it. I've got like a week left, actually. So it's totally flown by. But it's been, I have to say, an extremely rewarding process. You know, it's also helped my speaking a little bit, even though the class isn't really focused on speaking. It's really just about translation. It's given me a deeper understanding of Arabic grammar and expanded my vocabulary a bit, so I can sort of understand a little bit more of what's being said in many contexts. So that's been good. And my first project
is for your kind of PhD.
Yeah, for my doctoral
aspirations
work
in the future. Yeah.
Yeah. So my eventual goal is, you know, by the time I'm 30, I want to have a really good handle on Arabic. Cause it's going to be one of my key research languages. So next thing I'll be doing with Arabic is reading the Gospel of John in the Van Dyck translation, which is like the Arabic King James. Although it's modern, it's like a 19th century Protestant translation, but it's accepted by Arab Christians, all the different Arabic Christian groups.
Like the definitive version.
Yes. Yeah. So it's the one, you know, it's like when Orthodox churches come to the United States, they often will use the King James or New King James version for their Bible. You know, it's kind of like it's acceptable. Everyone kind of agrees that, yes, this is a serious, solid Bible translation with elevated, you know, kind of English prose. The Van Dyck translation is kind of like that. So I'll start with the Gospel of John. You know, it's pretty easy and I know it fairly well. And so, you know, it'll help me sort of start translating. So I'm excited about that. I've also got a pretty major reading project coming up for the rest of my summer. But I can talk about that in future podcast episodes.
Yeah. All right. Teasing.
Yes, that's right. Stay tuned, everyone. Spotlight. What are we spotlighting today, Reese?
We are spotlighting the should still be forthcoming but newest publication from the Davenant Press, Reforming Classical Education Toward a New Paradigm. This will be published on the 2nd of August, and this collects together speeches and papers given originally at our 2021 National Convivium at Davenant House, which is all about education and the kingdom of God. It was a kind of state of the nation stop and take stock of classical Christian education, which is a movement that's sort of about three generations old, and the conference was a chance to take stock of where it's at, what questions can be asked, what direction is this movement going to, which Davenant is very much kind of supportive of, what movement is this, what direction is this movement going to go in the future. Our keynote speaker there was Jean Veith, Lutheran writer and great exponent of classical education. His keynote address is in there on like a distinctly Protestant vision of classical education. The whole book is really kind of loosely working on that angle, Protestant vision of classical education. Jean Veith's essay really gets into that, and Luther in particular. Brad Littlejohn, our president, writes a fantastic introduction essay. And then Colin Chan Redimer, our absconded co-host, has a great essay there about the value of teaching Plato, or lack thereof, in a Christian education. Mike Lynch, who actually was on this podcast, I think, during that convivium to talk
about
education.
We had him on live at the convivium.
Yeah, which is somehow one of the most listened to episodes of the episode ever, of the podcast ever. And he may have talked about this actually on that episode, but he has a great essay kind of tackling the sacred cow of teaching Latin in classical education, which, you know, someone who does teach it, I think, as part of his living, has some boots to stick in about the way and reasons in which we teach Latin now, as if, you know, teaching Latin therefore makes a classical education. And other great essays in there as well that you can get a hold of for just $23.95 of your Yankee dollars. You can pre-order it now. See a free sample on the new and improved Davenant Institute website as well.
We should. Our Yankee dollars, which are now worth more than European euros. So, you know.
I know, for the first time.
The dollar is on the up and up. We're making it, guys.
Good times to be paid in dollars.
Bad for exporters, good for importers, I guess. Cool. All right. Well, thank you very much for that spotlight, Reese. It's been a pleasure talking to you in Colin's absence. Because of Colin's absence? I'll leave it ambiguous. In Colin's absence, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Just kidding. We look forward to having Colin back next time. But for now, we are the editors. This is the Ad Fontes podcast, and we will see you next week.